Well, as I was just saying, this summer, this weekend, you know, traditionally in American society, kind of marks the beginning of summer. It means the beginning of summer camp season, although not the beginning of camp season. I'm sure that Dean and Jerry would say just summer camp season. That's the perhaps the distinction for them. And many of you saying kumbaya, I could see that you know it. And perhaps for you, you associate it with summer camp. I was exchanging some conversation with David Meadows about the song and summer camp, and he said, you know, it really is the quintessential summer camp song. And I think that's quite true. So much so that as part of my research for today, I discovered there's a camp in Kentucky that is named Camp Kumbaya. Right? It almost seems redundant. And, of course, Donna and Lauren have been playing for us this Joel Rainey suite of pieces. You'll hear the rest of them during the offertory and in the postlude as well. A kind of meditation in different ways on the different verses of Kumbaya. And it was really hearing that, they played part of it, you may remember, back in the winter. And when they played it, I was very struck by it. I like that these Rainey arranged pieces they've been doing in general, but this one really spoke to me. And along the way, it got me thinking about the song. And I knew a little of the song's history, and I thought, you know, how did we arrive at this point where Kumbaya is well known in central Pennsylvania and known in many other places, really known all over not only the United States, but it's known internationally as well. And some of you probably have some background where you may be aware of the story behind that, but I hope to, among other things this morning, kind of give you the history of the song, because I'm a historian. But what's interesting, I think, on top of the history of the song, is not just where it came from, but the change it's gone through in the past generation. And I perhaps used that change just earlier. We've come to use it in this way. We're not going to have a kumbaya moment, right? Right. That is a phrase that has meaning in our society today. I think that interpretation is wrong. I think it's a misuse, not only of what the song is about, but I think it's perhaps a sort of denial of the song's history in important ways, and I hope to show you that that is the case before we're done. So, as I say, there's a little in the origins of kumbaya, or come by here, which of course is what it is really asking, right? Come by here, Lord, to lead you to expect that it would become an internationally known piece of folk music, or that summer camps all over America would sing it. There's much less reason to expect that the view of the song would get caricatured in the way that I think it has, as some kind of signal of shallow happiness. One of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in this song is its sort of core origins, right, which are beginnings among the Gullah or Geechee people. So typically, they're one people, broadly speaking, the Gullah and the Geechee, but in Georgia, as in so many things, they're a little wrong, and so they say Geechee, and in the Carolinas, they do it better and say Gullah. In general, they have been on my mind, the Gullah and Geechee, partly because of some friends of mine who are scholars and are from that community and have kind of engaged me in a way to want to think a lot more about who they are and who they have been and also where they're headed as a culture. Next fall, I'll teach a course at a nearby college that on the Carolina Lowcountry and the Gullah. So it's truly on my mind and in a lot of my reading these days. So the Gullah people, in case you don't already know, are the descendants of slaves. Broadly speaking, we kind of see them as being from around Wilmington, North Carolina, to about Jacksonville, Florida. Primarily in the Sea Islands, where under slavery they would have grown Sea Island cotton, and in the mainland in the what some of us call the Rice Kingdom, where they, of course, grew rice. And as part of that culture, of course, people have moved. People come out of it and become famous. Just to give you a few examples, Michelle Obama is Gullah in her ancestry. So is Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas. Michael Jordan is, and so was Joe Frazier, right, the great boxer. So beginning with the earliest arrival of slaves in the 17th century in the Carolinas, mainly Charleston, right, one of the things that often is not known among white Americans but is a fairly routine understanding among African Americans is Charleston is the Ellis Island for black America, right? Overwhelmingly, a black American can trace their ancestry's arrival through Charleston. Some ancestor will almost certainly come through there. That's the reality of their past. So what allows for sort of Gullah to become a culture, right, is a process that anthropologists, historians call creolization, right? It's a Creole culture. That is to say, it's a mix of cultures. On the one hand, you have people brought from West Africa, right, from what today is more than a half dozen different nations and represented many more cultures and languages, right, in the 17th and 18th century. You have Native Americans already living in the area, Creek and Cherokee and others, and they already have ways of living on the land, and the new arrivals, whether they are white, German, French, British Isles immigrants, bringing with them their cultures and languages, or whether they are enslaved people from West Africa, together they do create a bit of a stew of languages and religious practices and foods like shrimp and grits. But I'm only going to name one. No matter how many I think of, I'm only going to name one. Folk tales, which you probably know, like Br'er Rabbit, and many others in that vein. And, of course, they created a rich musical tradition, as well as a language, right? Gullah. And a few times at Stone I have read from the New Testament translation into Gullah, which was completed about 10 years ago now. So one of those elements is Kumbaya, right? The song's history as a recorded thing tells us something about its origins, but it doesn't, of course, tell us how deep those origins go. So the tune may go back to Africa. It may have been invented on Hilton Head Island 200 years ago, or it may have been invented around Savannah, Georgia, 150 years ago. We don't really know how deep those go because it's out of oral tradition. But we do know when it begins to be written down and when it begins to be recorded. So the earliest written account we have is in the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress, and that's from 1928. It was in the founding documents to create that library, not the Library of Congress, but the Archive of Folk Song. It was recorded, transcribed around coastal North Carolina, just outside of Wilmington, right? And then at almost the same time, just a year or so earlier, actually, down around Darien, Georgia, a folk collector recorded on cylinders, right? This is the early stuff, right? A true cylinder, right? I have to explain CDs to my kids, but cylinders were more portable than any other form of recording device and among the earliest types. And so we have a 1928 recordings on cylinder of this song with very clearly the tune as well as the words, right, in Gullah. And then at about the same time, in the 20s, we don't know exactly when the recording date was. We know when the publication date came, around 1929 or 30, around Charleston, it was clearly also with the same tune and approximately the same words. So we have multiple spots, all in the 20s, along that sort of Gullah corridor where people are recording essentially the same song. It would be interesting to know but we never will, who thought of it, right? In a matter of a decade or so more, the 30s and 40s, we begin to find, other collectors of folk material begin to find the song in Mississippi, in Alabama, and even Texas. So this is a song that apparently begins in the slave, in the era of slavery, and spreads, especially as, after emancipation, African Americans begin to be much more mobile and spread around, spread both west and north. So in learning how this song gets from the Deep South to a summer camp, say, in Oregon, or to Camp Blue Diamond, we have to go through Ohio. Just wanted to prepare you. Now, specifically, I have to go through Oberlin. Sadly, our Oberlin affiliated people aren't here today. We have some alumni and parents of alumni of Oberlin here. Oberlin was at kind of a nexus of the folk revival. Now, this seems appropriate given we had the hymn sang this morning and folk college has been going on here in Huntington all weekend. The folk college is kind of a longer-term byproduct of the folk revival of the 1950s, which focused on folk music. And Oberlin was a little hotbed for that, among other places. And we know that there was a student group in the 50s at Oberlin that made probably the first, we'll call it modern recording of the song. And they learned it from one of their professors. And he learned it from, we don't know, right? There's a hole there somewhere between the 30s and the 50s. But apparently, from that little nexus at Oberlin, Pete Seeger learned the song. And in the 50s and 60s, if you wanted to make a song a big deal, turns out, we didn't know it at the time, right? You needed Pete Seeger to learn and like the song, right? He is, to some degree, not just a one man, but a powerful figure in helping songs go viral. So he learns the song, and the Weavers, right, his group, they record it in about 1958 or so. And that helps it spread through the entire sort of folk music revival of the 50s and 60s. So I think that gets us pretty far. That we know then where it comes from to some degree. We know how it spreads. Oh, I should say that the Weavers were the first to kind of make it one word, right? The Weavers decided instead of representing it as like three words, come by here, kumbaya, right, in kind of a Gullah rendering, that they made it, smushed it all together and made it one word. Maybe they were anticipating a hashtag. So part of the song's spread, I think, is about both the music. It's in one sense easy to learn, like many good folk songs. But its meaning. And it's not hard to understand or relate to this rather plaintive call in some verses for help, right? For companionship from God. The verse that says someone's praying to me, it seems like intercessory prayer, right? Someone's praying, it's maybe not about me, this is about me saying, come help my friend, come help my community member who needs you, God. There's nothing superficially happy about Kumbaya, right? It's not a particularly self-pleased song. In many ways, it's quite the opposite, right? After all, the verse, someone is crying, Lord. In some versions, someone's dying, Lord, is a verse. So how does this song then, this last part of its history, get turned around from this call for God's help and assistance to being something to mock other people's, I don't know, naive utopian visions? How does that happen? Well, these days, outside of summer camp, that's the version you will most likely bump into, right? People refer to kumbaya moments, but they don't mean literally this was a good moment, right? They're saying a kumbaya moment is a thing that will not happen, right? It's a symbol to bring up to suggest cynicism, right? Don't go believing that we can work that out. We're not going to have a kumbaya moment. In fact, the idea is taken a little further as I was looking into it. There is something called the kumbaya law, which says that in a debate, the The person who stakes out the more pessimistic position, right, or rejects the other person's argument as being too utopian, will say, why don't we just hold hands around a campfire and sing Kumbaya? Finding examples of this usage is surpassingly easy. Just to give you an indication, this week in Japan, President Obama used it. He said, it would be nice if everybody was immediately unified in singing Kumbaya. And that's a very typical example of how people use this today, right? It is clear what he meant. Only a wide-eyed innocent would think we could arrive at that place, right, of unity or peace or brotherhood or any of our most idyllic notions. The trend in this direction, I think, is about 30 years old. I think that's long enough, and I would suggest we don't have to be that cynical or pessimistic. The cynicism of our culture ruins the idea of the song, as well as misunderstanding it, and it perhaps undermines the idea of summer camp. The issue is larger, after all, than the song, because I think, or the vital experience of camp. It's about our everyday attitudes and how that kind of cynicism undermines us as individuals, as communities, and it undercuts our faith. I don't think the cynical view is really about the song at all, right? It uses and risks destroying the song, but it's really about its strong association with summer camp. Bonfires and guitars, that glorious mountaintop experience of closeness, possibility, optimism, that is, in the end, I think, the apotheosis of the camp experience. Well, that can be rejected and mocked because it isn't the real world, right? Summer camp isn't the real world. Or is it? One brethren preacher has said that when people invoke the real world, they are using one of a couple of arguments. I picked two of the arguments that this particular theologian came up with. One is the Grim Reaper paradigm, right? Which is recognized because, quote, it involves pain, suffering, weakness, greed, self-interest, inhumanity, bigotry. When those who can be seen, when those can be seen, we know it's the real world and not Kumbaya. The second category, identified by our preacher, let's just call him Andy Murray, is the bottom line paradigm. If it makes more money, if it attracts more people, it's more real. All right? So in this thinking, Sheets is real world. Junie out of college, not so much. Right? The world's more about MTOs than Plato. But to adapt Murray's thinking to my argument a little bit, summer camps, both religious and probably even secular ones, might be more real than people imagine. They employed in 2010 about 1,500,000 people, including some people who are going to be in this room, right? Who are in this room. They hosted in 2010, which was the most recent year I saw numbers for, around 11 million campers. So you're pushing 13 million if you assume some growth, maybe even more, in 2016. And that's all according to the American Camp Association. Well, I don't know what threshold of millions of people is yours for being real, but mine's certainly below 10 million. So I agree with Andy in dismissing the false dichotomy of some real world, right, and an unreal world, I think, which is a crucial part of this, right? Jesus and Christians today are in the real world. Our time worshiping together is real. Time at Camp Blue Diamond is as real as a week at work, even though it is special and typically better. But let's not reject the better as unreal. In fact, is it not during worship or at camp that individuals reveal their struggles? We are more likely, in a very good brethren sort of sense, to acknowledge our struggles more than our joys, I would say. At least that's an observation I've made. After all, it could risk being prideful, and that would not be brethren, right? To be too happy, too joyous, right? Celebrate too many successes or accomplishments among our community. As you can tell, I might think that that's not, we might not have that 100% right, because I think it misses the importance of togetherness, right? We get the importance of sharing our struggles together. We probably should also get the value, the way it uplifts us all to hear those joys, right? To hear that things are going well for our brothers and sisters, right? It's not enough to be peaceful and simple. We do it together. So I think the problem is our own attitude and cynicism sometimes. No doubt pain, inhumanity, violence, mental illness, loss, heartbreak, financial struggle are real, but so are their opposites. Love, compassion, peace, health, maybe the pleasure of eating and singing around a campfire. Deep issues do divide us, but to paraphrase a song I just heard last week, with so many things to get mad about, why focus on just one? Those attending annual conference for the Church of the Brethren, including, of course, our moderator, Andy Murray, Pastor Christie, and our delegates, I think maybe go this year with some reason of concern, right? Some specter, some sense of a specter of conflict and not kumbaya. And I think that's a shame for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which maybe is encapsulated in this. A student, Juniata, who's a preacher's kid, said, yeah, in regards to something on campus, she said, you know, sometimes you're preaching to the choir. People are hearing things they've heard before. That doesn't mean the choir doesn't need the sermon. And I think annual conference is partly about that. We need those kumbaya moments. Those are part of what conference is about. When we consider the portion of Matthew 18 that we read, it could seem like summer camp. Just go to your brother or sister, and as I read it, engage them not in retribution, not in punishment, but in restorative justice. Jesus lived in the real world. He knew that transgressions were bound to happen. And if you think about this passage, he specifically is saying transgressions are going to happen among and between members of the faith and even within the exact same church, right? He's planning for that. He's advising us on exactly that. That's not naive optimism. It's dealing with reality. So we all know the challenge. Then we get to verse 22, right? When Jesus says, well, I like to render it this way. If you're counting your forgiving, you're doing it wrong. In light of those passages, never mind the Sermon on the Mount, can we doubt that our command is to do what others mock, to hold hands and sing kumbaya? I think those mocking the song, sneering at it, maybe applying snark and cynicism rather than forgiveness and forbearance, have missed the point. The point of the song, the point of summer camp, perhaps even the point of our faith, or at least one of the points of our faith. We sing, come by here, O Lord, not because we are naive, but despite knowing that we must always try to live with hope and optimism, even though troubles are always with us. Amen.